Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the illegal drug trade between Mexico and the United States and about the increasing importance of Mexico as a source of illegal drugs. As a result, there is a great deal of drug-related violence in Mexico as drug gangs battle with each other for control of the trade and also battle with the police. And in addition to being a destination for drugs, the United States has another interesting way that it connects into this problem because, according to the authorities in Mexico, a significant number, maybe nearly all, of the guns that are used in Mexico in this drug-related violence come from the United States. We'll be talking this morning in this hour with Samuel Logan. He is a senior analyst with a company called Riskline. This is a private consulting firm. They have analysts based in 10 major cities around the world, and it is their business to provide information on security to people who will be traveling, whether they're going there outside of the country, going to various places, whether they're going there for business or whether they're going for pleasure. He also has been an investigative journalist. He makes his home in Rio, Brazil, has a master's degree in international policy studies from the Monterey Institute of International Studies, and has worked as a regional and political security and risk analyst in Central and South America for a variety of companies and organizations in Argentina, Chile, Mexico, the U.S., and Europe. And this is over the past 10 years. And he is particularly interested in, has particular expertise in the areas of organized crime, black markets, street gangs, smuggling, and political processes. And in fact, is working on a book that will be coming out soon, looking at these subjects as well as the subject of human trafficking. So as we talk in this part of Focus 580, questions from people who are listening are welcome. The only thing that we ask of people who are calling in is that people are brief in their comments so that we can keep our program moving along and get as many different people as possible. But certainly people who are listening are welcome to join the conversation. You can do that by calling us. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long distance call, that number is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Logan, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Hi, happy to be here today.
We certainly appreciate it. I'm sure if people think about the trade in drugs, international drug trade, that they would certainly appreciate that perhaps Central America and South America are and continue to be important, and probably one country that seems to stand out as being a source of illegal drugs has been for a long time. I'm interested in how it is now that Mexico, apparently in recent years, has become much, much more important in the drug trade as it has been in the past, and that's not to say that it wasn't involved at all in the past, but according to some of the things that I read, it's, for example, that almost 80% of the cocaine that's consumed in the United States at one time passes through Mexico, and it's also become an important producer of both heroin and methamphetamines. Can you just sort of place Mexico in the drug trade in this hemisphere and talk about its growing importance?
Sure. Well, why don't we begin by going back to the late 90s and maybe 2000.
Mm-hmm.
When we're looking at some of the trends or some of the latest trends that have come out, that's sort of the time period or where the time period begins at 2000, extending until through the end of last year. And towards the end of the 90s, Mexico was still considered a transshipment country. When we're talking about cocaine and heroin, it was considered a transshipment country because the cartels, the so-called cartels in Colombia, were still very much in control of the complete supply chain of cocaine. And that would be from what they call the farm gate, which is where the coca leaves are turned into coca paste. Through the production of cocaine, where they cook the paste and turn it into the powder that's then used on the streets, The next segment would then be the transshipment that is often over land, which would then pass through Mexico, and then to the reception points controlled again by Colombians inside the United States at major distribution centers. Think of Atlanta or Chicago or New York, Los Angeles, Miami. So over time, as what is called Plan Colombia, which was the U.S. government's strategy to reduce demand in the United States by controlling, by reducing the supply of cocaine, thereby increasing the prices on the street. Through that plan and the ensuing years, the Colombian cartels were significantly weakened, which then created a vacuum for the Mexican cartels to come in and fill the space. And so over this time period that we're talking about, we've seen where Mexico has been involved in increasingly in so the supply chain. And the Colombians have risked their involvement from the final distribution point and the transshipment to basically controlling what happens in Colombia, which would again be the farm gate, the coca paste production, and the actual cocaine production. But then from there, they've handed it over in large part to the Mexicans or the Mexican organized criminal factions. So what we've seen is a trend where all of the cocaine that goes into the U.S., that is consumed in the U.S., has gone from having roughly 75% of it passing through Mexico to what I've seen. You mentioned 80%. I've seen as high as 90% passing through Mexico. But more importantly, it's that the Mexicans are receiving the cocaine, in some cases, within Colombia, but in most cases, in areas of Mexico that have been, up until maybe 2005, considered tourist destinations like Cancun or Acapulco. Last year, for example, there was a rather alarming chain of or pattern of violence in Acapulco, where people were seeing policemen being killed. There were some decapitations and other sorts of alarming types of crimes that hadn't been seen before. So placing Mexico within the context of the drug trade, its role has increased significantly as Colombia's role has been decreased or diminished. And then secondly, as routes through the Caribbean, and think here of some of the Dutch Caribbean islands or some of the French Caribbean islands, or Puerto Rico, for example, Haiti, Jamaica, as some of these transshipment routes have been shut down by the U.S. Coast Guard and the Drug Enforcement Administration. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the focus has come to Mexico for those reasons and many others.
And then as a result, in Mexico, as I mentioned, there has been and sounds like a significant increase in drug-related violence. For example, one figure that I saw said that, say, roughly speaking, between January of this year and October, more than 2,100 people were killed. These were drug-related deaths or deaths associated with the drug trade in Mexico, and that was significantly over the total of the number of for all of the year before. Is that are those numbers, you know, from what anybody knows, relatively in the ballpark?
That's relatively accurate. Of course, there are many, many murders that go unreported. Think of the people that are kidnapped and subsequently murdered execution style, and their bodies never found. Mm-hmm. An attorney general's office is announcing those numbers are accurate. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And here, just to pull in the another connection to the United States, so that not only is the United States an endpoint, or perhaps in some cases, I'm not sure if it's a through shipping point, or if the drugs that end up coming in the United States are consumed in the United States. The interesting other part of this triangle, if you think about it in that way, is the shipment of the smuggling of guns. And we're talking about here in some cases what people in Mexico are looking at is heavy firepower, military-style assault weapons, AK-47s and AR-15s, these kind of guns are being purchased, in some cases, I suppose, legally purchased in the United States, but then being smuggled into Mexico. And again, one of the really striking numbers that I'd seen is that the Mexican government has estimated that something like 2,000 guns go from the United States to Mexico every day, most of them coming from Texas, California, and Arizona. Is that? Do you think that that's an accurate number, 2,000 guns a day?
Well, in as much as the Attorney General's office in Mexico is accurate, yeah, that's a report that they have put out that was then sort of digested and distributed around the country in Mexico through some of Mexico's larger national chain newspapers. And that was during President Vicente Fox's six-year presidential term from 2000 to 2006. So since then, there are some analysts who would argue that the number has increased because the current president, Felipe Calderon, has really taken the fight to the drug cartels in Mexico, thereby increasing, so the argument goes, increasing the demand for heavy firepower used by the organized criminals, as they are now fighting the Mexican army and not so much anymore the Mexican National Police Forces, but actual trained soldiers who are, trained for heavy artillery combat situations, and heavily armed combat situations. And that number would also be accurate.
Yeah, and that sounds like in indeed what we are talking about is heavily armed combat situations where you have people have the drug gangs armed with fully automatic weapons and in some cases other things that are even a step up from that.
Yeah, well, there have been reports of things, weapons such as grenades or grenade launchers. I haven't seen anything by way of a missile launcher. But in February, a Mexican customs agent stopped a truck in Matamoros, Mexico, which is just across the border from Brownsville. The truck had been coming south from the U.S., and the agent seized a load of weapons, and in that seizure were 17 grenades. He was actually killed the next day with an AK-47 for doing his job. But in a separate seizure made in October of this year, they did seize one grenade launcher that, according to Mexican newspapers, has enough power to stop a tank. So that's a bit of firepower.
Yeah, and apparently the way this works is that we are talking about purchases on a small scale. That is, someone will buy a small number of guns, and either in those small numbers, so we're talking about, I don't know, 2, 3, 4, 6, and these things are smuggled into Mexico in these small batches, which makes it, I'm sure, that much more difficult to try to stop it, because we're not talking about a big truck load of guns. We're talking about a car, a truck, or some kind of vehicle that would have it concealed in it a small number. And then, although many of these small shipments going across the border.
Certainly. Yeah, they call that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms in the United States calls that ant trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
Because they envision that there are many, many different individuals involved in trafficking small numbers of firearms, crossing at a number of different border crossings between the United States and Mexico. And you're exactly right. These firearms are concealed, inside the door of a car, where you can imagine you could probably fit one AR-15 rifle, maybe with a reduced stock on it, or in the trunk, where you could put a 5 or 6 pistols, high caliber pistols, in areas like that. So you have a number of individuals who make these purchases, and then they transfer those weapons to the smuggler, if they're not themselves a smuggler, who then drives his or her car south. And then meets with the appropriate individual once in Mexico. So ant trafficking would be the key word there.
Apparently, again, as I understand it, guns are difficult to purchase legally in Mexico. There are many more restrictions than there are in the United States. So I take it that for those people who are smuggling weapons from the United States into Mexico, there is significant money to be made in this trade.
Yes, yes, there is. And just a note of clarification, it's not just individuals connected with Mexican organized crime that do this. It's Mexican civilians for the exact reason that you said. Mexico has very, very strict firearm possession legislation that is fairly strictly enforced. And if you want to buy a firearm in Mexico, you have to go to a nationally licensed dealer, and the bureaucracy of the process is such a headache that so many people would rather just go to the United States, where it's much, much easier. The money to be made is based on either a commission, which could be between $50 and $100 per weapon, if you happen to be an individual purchasing the weapons, and then hand it off to the smuggler. If you're more involved in the complete process, you can buy, for example, an AK-47 rifle that has been formatted or prepared, let's say, for hunting. In other words, you squeeze the trigger and one shot goes off. Not even really semi-automatic. You purchase one of those for maybe a used would be $400 up to maybe as much as $2,000, depending on the model and the age. So you purchase it at that price, and then you can sell for perhaps double or maybe triple that price, according to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, mm-hmm. once inside Mexico. So you can make quite a bit of money once you cross the border. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely money to be made. Mm-hmm.
Let me reintroduce again our guest, Samuel Logan. He is a senior analyst with a company called Riskline. This is a private consulting firm that provides information on security to businesses, to individuals, information on security conditions in various countries around the world. They have 15 analysts based in 10 major cities worldwide that are providing this service. Our guest, Samuel Logan, makes his home in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And we're talking here this morning about the illegal drug trade between Mexico and the United States, and about the fact that particularly in recent years, Mexico and drug gangs in Mexico have become much more important than they had in the past in providing illegal drugs to the United States. And as a part of this, in a sense, as a part of this trade, also the United States has become an important source of weapons for people who are involved in the drug trade in Mexico. As he has just explained, the government of Mexico has made this estimate that at least during the presidency of the last president, Vicente Fox, that as something like 2,000 guns a day were going from Mexico, going from the United States into Mexico, being smuggled into Mexico. And that they also estimate that of these more than 2,100 deaths, more probably associated with the drug trade, it's their feeling that most of the weapons used in those killings actually came from the United States. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have someone to talk with here in the nearby community of Belgium. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. We have, seems like, three very, fairly prominent problems with our southern neighbors. Drugs, and it seems though we have weapons problems, and we have illegal immigration. Seems there is one common thread through all three of those, and that's money, profitability. If we take the profitability out of drugs, then they probably won't be such a demand for the illegal weapons, which takes the profitability out of them. And if we treat our southern neighbors the way we should and take care of them the way we should, we wouldn't have the illegal immigrant problems, which just needs money because they need jobs. Seems it always gets down to profitability, don't you think?
Well, Mr. Logan, you can comment on that any way you see fit.
Sure, sure. I think your caller raises a very interesting angle and very interesting way to look at this situation. When you sort of zoom out and look at everything involved, the money to be made in selling guns from north to south, the money to be made in selling drugs from south to north, or from trafficking humans from south to north, in the case of human trafficking, where there's quite a bit of money to be made, second only to the drug traffic. One thing that people tend to talk about or think about is decriminalization or legalization of some of these drugs. As has been experimented in some European countries. Even here in Brazil, that's been something that's been tabled by.
Hello.
We just had a brief drop. Maybe I should mention that we're doing this with Sam Logan as an internet phone call, which we've actually, I don't think we've ever done this before. So generally, I think it's working pretty well here, but the audience might have to bear with us on the occasion there. We might have a tiny dropout, but Logan, go ahead.
Okay, I'll just back up a little bit. I was saying that concerning the profitability, one of the ways to reduce that is by decriminalizing or legalizing some of these drugs. Specifically, cocaine and heroin is what many people like to talk about. But when you think of the social mores inside the United States and some of the social mores that are constructed around international organizations like the United Nations concerning the use and misuse of drugs, it's politically unpopular. And until that sort of status quo changes, it'll be very difficult to reduce profitability vis-a-vis legalization or decriminalization. Another way, of course, is to reduce demand, which is something else I was hoping to talk about during today's show. But demand reduction also remains, politically speaking, remains unpopular.
Does it get at your question, caller?
Yes, sir, it does. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, do you want to talk about demand reduction?
Sure, yeah, I'd be happy to. One of the largest bodies of individuals inside Washington and around the nation in terms of think tanks, in terms of non-governmental organizations that look at these issues, one of the largest bodies has gathered around the argument that the so-called war on drugs will not end until the United States government takes a hard look at the demand. And they say, look, it's simply economics. As long as there is a demand for these drugs, as your caller pointed out, there will be a demand for the weapons. And as long as there's a demand for these drugs, it doesn't matter what you do on the supply side, because simple economics argues that where there's demand, there will always be supply. Yet, year to date, since going as far back as 1990, the U.S. government really hasn't taken a good hard look at demand in terms of the money it wants to put into demand reduction strategies, these being treatment centers for heavy addicts or maybe hardcore users, or maybe school prevention programs, which, to be fair, have been found to not be as effective. But at the same time, looking at the economics of demand, some studies done by the RAND Corporation, for example, a fairly prestigious think tank out of Santa Monica and Washington, have discovered that by looking at demand reduction versus supply reduction, demand reduction is much more economically feasible in terms of how much reduction in consumption you achieve per dollar spent on that, as opposed to how much reduction in consumption you achieve per dollar spent on supply side, such as, you know, the policy of eradication of coca bush plantations in Colombia, or another supply-side reduction strategy would be along the lines of enforcement. Enforcement in Colombia in terms of money spent in training the Colombian National Police, or money spent in training the Colombian military to combat drug traffickers in Colombia. So when you look at demand reduction, it all comes back to the same problem, and that has to do with politicians. Individual politicians in the United States Congress are simply not in a politically feasible position to support demand reduction strategies that, for example, may see a needle swap center in, you know, in a neighborhood where they have constituents, and those constituents aren't going to be happy when a needle swap center is installed, thereby possibly reducing the value of the land in the surrounding neighborhood, for example. That's a very acute example, but when you look at demand reduction strategies, it's very hard to look at it on a national level. You have to go to individual communities and start there and work your way up.
Yeah, and it seems that, that unfortunately, or some people would say unfortunately, when here in this country we've been talking about, when we do talk about demand reduction, we don't talk about education, we don't talk about drug treatment, we talk about law enforcement and stiff penalties for people using drugs, even people who apparently are in possession of small amounts of drugs, not just big suppliers, but also small end users. That seems to be still the sort of the almost the starting and the ending point when we talk about dealing with the user end of the trade.
Right, right. Well, I would just mention that a fairly popular movie that was done with Johnny Depp, I think it was called Blow, if I'm not mistaken. There was a scene in the movie where he went to prison for actually a rather large amount of marijuana possession, but he came out, you know, knowing much better the demand and supply in the business of cocaine. So that is to say, you may get busted for a small amount of a you know a controlled substance, but less damaging one, and you come out of prison with an education to do the trafficking of a much more damaging controlled substance such as cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
Another point I would add on the demand reduction strategy versus the supply reduction strategy is that demand reduction goes directly at the problem. It goes directly at the reduction of consumption, especially when you focus on heavy users that the RAND Corporation defines as an individual who uses cocaine, for example, once a week, at least once a week or more, as opposed to recreational users that would use it you know, perhaps less than once a week. So when you look at it that way, demand reduction strategies go directly at the problem, whereas the supply reduction strategy that argue, okay, if we reduce supply, it increases price, thereby reducing demand. That's indirectly affecting consumption. So it's a bit of a roundabout way to get at the problem.
Mm-hmm. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. I have another call I will get to in just a moment, but I would like to introduce again our guest, Samuel Logan. He's a senior analyst with Riskline. This is a private consulting firm that provides information on security conditions around the world, many places. They have 15 analysts that are based in 10 major cities around the world that provide real-time intelligence on conditions in various countries, providing it both to individuals and to businesses. He is an investigative journalist. He lives in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, has a master's degree in international policy studies from the Monterey Institute of International Studies, and has worked as a regional and political security and risk analyst in Central and South America and for a variety of companies and organizations in Argentina, Chile, Mexico, the U.S., and Europe. He's particularly interested in organized crime, black markets, street gangs, smuggling, and is working on a book looking at that, also looking at the issue of human trafficking. 333-9455 is our number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just quickly, I'm curious about who are the clients of Riskline? Who uses Riskline's services, and what exactly are they interested in?
Well, the clients that use Riskline services are clients. These are corporate clients that I'm referring to at this point.
Mm-hmm.
They are the corporate clients who normally send middle managers or up to VP or perhaps even CEOs to hotspots around the world for different reasons. Think of mining companies. Think of oil and gas energy companies, perhaps even retail companies who send people out into the world to look at different different areas. Again, on the supply side of the procurement chain. So some of Riskline clients have individuals who travel to places like Nigeria, or to southern Thailand, or to Sao Paulo, Brazil, even, mm-hmm. Or Colombia, or Venezuela. And what they want to know is what's going on the ground in terms of things that will impact them. It can range from civil unrest. Venezuela, for example, has had quite a bit of civil unrest lately that, you know, is just halted all traffic in downtown Caracas. That's good to know before you get there. Nigeria has a bit of a insurgency over control of oil assets, which has led to quite a bit of kidnappings of foreign nationals. So that's good to know before you get there.
Yeah.
So these types of clients are interested in Riskline services, and RISC-ON is going after the European market at this point, so many Europe-based clients.
Yeah, so it's people who are interested, companies who are interested in keeping their employees safe as they do their jobs, various places around.
Exactly. And it's updated by the hour for 290 countries and territories around the world in terms of the information feed that you can opt to receive. It's quite good in that sense.
And just to make sure that people understand here, I want to make sure that people understand that it's not at RISC-ON. It's not a company that's in the business of supplying security services. It's not like Blackwater or something like that.
No, not at all. Oh. Not at all. It's in the business of supplying information.
All right.
Information. Yeah.
We have some other callers here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. We'll go next to Champagne in line one. Hello.
Thank you. Yeah, you may consider this to be a minor part of it. I don't know. But and going to the issue of lack of political will to reduce the demand side, one of the dirty little secrets of all this, and I haven't heard you discuss this yet, although I came in somewhat late, is that money laundering is a real profitable area for a number of banks. And, this is something that I think that, the government is pretty lax about in terms of their war on drugs. And one thing that it struck me back in the when they really started pushing to make money harder to counterfeit, the first thing they went after was the $100 bill. And the $100 bill is one of the things that makes money laundering a great deal easier than if, people were having to deal with smaller denominations.
Well, Mr. Logan, you comment on that?
Sure. Again, thank you to your caller for bringing up a very important aspect of this whole, of everything we're looking at here. Money laundering, I would argue, is the weakest link of everything. We have seen in a number of cases where if you go after the money, you deal a very severe blow to the network itself relative to going after the actual leaders of a drug smuggling network, because leaders are much more easily replaced than millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars. Within the United States, since September 11, 2001, money laundering legislation has progressively put more of the onus on the banks to regulate the money flows that are going through their networks. But it's very, very difficult. Money laundering strategies, much like the gun trafficking strategies, employ a number of individuals who, in the case of the first stage of money laundering, there's three stages of money laundering. The first stage being called placement, the second stage being called layering, and the third stage referred to by different names, but it's basically getting the money out of the system and into an area wherever you want to spend it. But in the placement stage, you can have up to dozens of individuals who make small deposits of $10,000 or less into the formal financial system, and according to U.S. legislation, that doesn't raise a red flag in some cases, which means that the dirty money goes in, $10,000 in cash. Once it's in the account, it's bounced around the world vis-a-vis wire transactions, and that's the layering. And then once it comes out on the other end, clean money, it's then withdrawn or deposited in an account in Colombia or in Mexico. So it's very hard to get after money launderers. But the U.S. Treasury Department has been very aggressive in going after U.S. financial institutions that unwittingly or not have had money laundering activities passing through their networks. Most recently, in August of this year, American Express, which, a credit card that many Americans hold, I have one in my pocket, but American Express agreed to pay a $65 million fine to the Justice Department that was tied to its international private banking group, which was used to launder $55 million of Colombian drug proceeds. And to date, that's the largest fine ever paid out by a U.S. financial institution. So there is some activity going on, and there are very, very heavy fines to be paid. But at the end of the day, it's not only the banks that are being used, it's individuals who, for example, have a van, and again, they have these false compartments, the same type of compartments used to smuggle weapons, and they will fill it full of bulk cash. It can be in hundreds, as your caller pointed out. It could also be in 20s. Most recently, at least the last example that I've seen, was when an individual, a 49-year-old male, he had made 15 separate trips from the United States to Mexico in his van, carrying as much as $1 million a trip, and he was paid $15,000 per trip to make that sort of courier trip from, I believe it was somewhere in southeastern Texas to a ranch that he had in Durango, in the state of Durango in Mexico. So we're also seeing these bulk cash transfers. There's also transfers where they're called casas de cambio, exchange houses in Mexico, are used to launder money, where these exchange houses have bank accounts with U.S. banks, and so individuals on the U.S. side who receive the money from the sale of the narcotics in the U.S. make deposits in those banks, as I mentioned before, in small amounts. And then that money is then wired to the exchange houses in Mexico, where then the money is paid out to the Mexican organized crime. And the exchange houses are very loose in terms of the regulation that's put upon them. So money laundering is like I said, a weak link. You can get after organized crime in that way, but it's also the most difficult link in terms of establishing a legal case and having the evidence.
Well, you know, $65 million might seem like a lot of money to some people, but considering the scale of the actual trade, you know, it could be considered just a cost of doing business the same way that they consider the drugs that actually get caught as just, you know, it's a fraction, and that's just part of the cost we factor into doing business.
Exactly. It is. That's how it's treated. It's a cost of doing business. Some of the numbers that I've seen is that these drug traffickers in Mexico are and in Colombia combined are earning as much as $30 billion a year. So, $65 million or $55 million in this case, the money that was interdicted, let's say, or seized, it's a drop in the bucket. It really is.
You know, there's one thing that connects all these things, or that's common to all the things we talked about: the movement of contraband, for example, whether we were talking about drugs going north or guns going south, money going one way or the other, people going one way or the other, and that is the problem of border security, something that has been much discussed in the discussion about what we do about illegal immigration. We have a long border with Mexico, and it seems that in as much as some people say what we ought to do is build a wall, that doesn't really seem to be a particularly practical kind of solution. But I wonder what anybody thinks, particularly what people in Mexico think about the issue of just how easy it is to get across the border one way or another, and what can be done about that.
Well, people that I've spoken with in Mexico in terms of the human trafficking and illegal immigration that happens, the first thing that they're going to talk to you about is not the U.S.-Mexico border. They're going to talk to you about the Mexico-Guatemala border, which is basically a line on paper, but beyond that, you can walk across. So what you have are the perspectives of many Central Americans who look around in their own countries and say, okay, I live in a very violent place. El Salvador, for example, had upwards of 6,000 homicides in 2006, compared to Mexico that had around 2,000 homicides or more in 2006. And El Salvador is the size of one of the smaller northeastern states of the United States. So consider that these people look around and they all go into Mexico. So Mexico, when they talk about borders, they're thinking, you know, we have to do something about our Guatemala border, and they, you know, while they are cognizant of what's going on with the U.S.-Mexico border, they think that there needs to be much more pushback from Washington in terms of working with Mexico on that. Of course, there are economic incentives to you know, in terms of jobs, so that Mexicans choose to stay in Mexico, or Central Americans choose to stay in Central America. But when we look at the border itself between the U.S. and Mexico, when I look at it, I try and zoom out again and look at all of the different solutions that are being tabled or implemented. That there is a wall that is currently being built, as you pointed out. There are tunnels that are found, two or three at least are found a year. There are people that are using a sea route. There are individuals who come in with false documents, into America's airports. There's a virtual fence, and, you know, border patrol and, you know, all these different crossings. I think it's a very complicated issue, and when you zoom out, individual communities in some cases. So when we're looking at the border and looking at how to stop the movement of goods across the border, I think it's important to note that, you know, that Mexico and the U.S. are very important economic trading partners. So in a sense, the border will never be completely sealed. And at the same time, when Mexicans look at what the United States is doing to seal other parts of the border that are not border crossings or formal border crossings, Mexicans are always going to complain that the U.S. is going about it in the wrong way, probably because U.S. politicians don't spend too much time speaking with their Mexican colleagues when they're coming up with policies on a communal level to deal with border crossing. Hmm.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Let me again introduce our guest, Samuel Logan. He's a senior analyst with a company called Riskline. This is a private consulting firm that provides information mostly, I think, to corporate clients so that they can be sure that their employees who are doing business various places around the world will be safe. He's an investigative journalist. He makes his home in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And is interested in the things that we're talking about here, organized crime, black markets, street gangs, smuggling, and so forth. And we've been talking about the drug trade involving Mexico, how it has become more important as a source of drugs for the United States, and how also the United States has become an important source for the drug trade and people involved in the drug trade in Mexico. The United States has become a very important source of guns that are used in this increasing violence, drug-related violence that we have seen over the past few years in Mexico. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Up next, we have a caller in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
My thoughts are swirling around here with all the interesting things people are saying and you're saying. My thoughts about this have to do with side things and the whole issue of using the term war on drugs. Somehow it seems as though war on terrorism, war on drugs bypasses the issue. It puts the emphasis on violence in return rather than on prevention. And I'm wondering how all these interrelated things like prostitution, the drug manufacturers' profits, the drug dealers, not the drug, the gun manufacturers' profits, the gun dealers' profits, the gun lobby in the U.S., if there was less prostitution, golly, what would our men do? All these things, I don't see us, if you take away drugs from some communities, you end up, and you don't find other ways to train people for jobs and provide work, people are still going to find some way to make money that's not going to be legal if they can't find a legal way to do it. It seems, you know, I like this as a really, really, really knotty problem, and I think it's really interesting that you're talking about this whole issue of increasing violence because of this whole conundrum. I don't know if I'm making sense here, but I just thought I would toss those other things into the discussion.
All right. Well, again, Mr. Logan, you can comment on whatever piece of that you want.
Sure. Well, I'll start with calling it what it is and calling it what it isn't. A lot of times when I write about these things, I don't spend much time writing about the war on terror, as it's called. But when I do write about the war on drugs in print, I often use quote-unquote so-called war on drugs because that's the handle that's been put on it over time, which I think for many reasons couches this whole political debate in terms of a way to gain more funding. When you use the word war, simply put, people begin to think of an increased net necessity or increased urgency behind the matter. So there you get war on terror, war on drugs. One of the issues with funding in terms of the United States and the funding for combating the war on drugs has to do with what comes down to who gets what part of the budget for next year. And that's sliced between, you know, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the U.S. Coast Guard, local law enforcement, and then in Mexico, it's the same thing. Although in Latin America, we don't see, or at least I don't see, any reference to the word war in Spanish or in Portuguese when they're talking about these things. It seems to me to be a Washington-centric issue or focus. So again, I don't know who was the first one to call it a war on drugs, but it seems to have stuck, for better or for worse. And I think for better in terms of funding and for worse in terms of, as you pointed out, violence. And a focus on violence rather than a focus on prevention. Another issue, if you take away the drugs and you take away reasons for, or at least illicit reasons for why people in impoverished areas of Latin America tend to move north or tend to leave where they are, I absolutely agree. I think you will always find other means or other ways that people are gonna perhaps break the law or basically do what they have to do to put bread on the table. I think that's something that we've seen, at least in the Western Hemisphere, over hundreds of years in terms of when you think of the black market. People who haven't had any other licit means for putting bread on the table have turned to illicit means for doing so. In Brazil, it started with semi-precious gems. We've seen that in Africa as well with diamonds. And over time, it's grown. In parts of Colombia, people do it with gasoline because gas in Venezuela is much cheaper than it is in Colombia. So they smuggle gas into Colombia from Venezuela, and they do the same thing from Venezuela into Brazil. We've seen it with guns. We see it with drugs. We see it with human beings and the sex trade. So it's not a question really of looking at the drugs in terms of where the black market is headed or where it's been. I think it's just a question of understanding that people do what they have to do to put bread on the table.
We're to a point here where we have about a minute or two, maybe more like one, and I guess I feel bad that we haven't at least talked a little bit about what the United States has committed to do to try to help Mexico deal with the drug problem. The administration has committed what seems to be a significant amount of money, more than $1 billion, although I'm sure that some people would argue that it should be more. What is the United States talking about doing to try to help Mexico with this problem?
Well, the Bush administration has put forward in a much larger budget request for 2008, $1.4 billion to be spent over a period of time, up to 3 years. And that's the first installment would be $500 million for Mexico, $50 million for Central America. That focuses on hardware, helicopters and surveillance planes, increased intelligence gathering capabilities, training for prosecutors and police, and sort of a number of other smaller details. But what it comes down to is that the U.S. Congress has yet to get on top of this. Own desires or take away its own arguments and whatnot. So it's up in the air. It's a great step forward, I think, but at the same time, there are still many, many questions in terms of how it's going to look in the final product, and then beyond that, what the implementation will look like.
And are the Mexicans putting any pressure on the United States to try to tighten the laws that deal with gun sales in the United States to do something about the movement of guns into Mexico?
Very, very much so. Very much so. The all the way up to the president, many Mexican leaders have said, look, this is the guns that are flowing south is a major problem. We need your help. And in some ways, people in the U.S. their hands are tied because of the very strong pro-gun lobby. The National Rifle Association spends a lot of money protecting the Second Amendment, which I think is a very valid endeavor. But at the same time, I think also the Mexican leaders have a very valid point. And it just comes down to, I think, information sharing, intelligence sharing, and getting down to improving levels of trust between agents in the U.S. and agents in Mexico, which unfortunately at this point are not as high as they ought to be.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it at this point because we've come to the end of the program here, or at least of this hour. Our guest, Samuel Logan, is a senior analyst with Riskline, a private security consulting firm. If you're, by the way, interested in finding out about Riskline, they do have a website. You can go to riskline.com. I've mentioned that you were working on a book dealing with some of these subjects, also human trafficking. Is that something that's likely to see print sometime soon?
Probably not before early 2009 at this point.
All right.
But I'm working on it. It'll be out soon enough, yeah.
All right. And do you have a publisher?
Yeah, I'm with Hyperion.
Ah, okay. Well, good. Well, maybe we'll talk again then sometime in the future.
I hope so.
Well, thanks very much. We appreciate it. Again, our guest, Samuel Logan, he's a senior analyst with Riskline, investigative journalist. He makes his home in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and was speaking from there.